Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
On Commons People this week, a thin Queen's speech.
And it is unforgivable that there is no clear plan to fix social care.
Victorious Tories won't mind.
It's been clear to Keir Starmer and to the Labour leadership that the Red Wall has been crumbling for 20 years.
And it's cautious cuddles from Monday.
Whoever I hug, I can assure you it will be done with caution and restraint. I'm not going to act it out now.
Hello and welcome to Commons People. I'm Arj Singh and joining me this week is Paul Waugh.
Hi, Arj.
Hi, Paul. Rachel Wearmouth's here.
Hi, Arj.
Hi, Rachel. And we're joined by the Conservative MP for Thirsk and Malton, Kevin Hollenrigh.
Hi, all.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
No, good to have you on. Well, Boris Johnson this week set out his legislative plan for the next year via the Queen's speech. Among the headline moves, the Prime Minister is planning to give adults access to student loans at any point in their lives, to claw back the power to call elections, and will make the NHS more accountable to ministers. But there's been a backlash over other measures, including mandatory voter ID, a delay to banning gay so-called conversion therapy, and an attempt to police free speech at universities. Several Tory MPs are also known to be unhappy about plans to water down planning regulations. And the speech was perhaps most notable for leaving out a plan for social care that the PM promised in 2019. Let's hear Keir Starmer on it.
Now 657 days since the Prime Minister stood on the steps of Downing Street and said, we will fix the crisis in social care once and for all with a clear plan we have prepared. We have prepared.
Paul, what did you make of the Queen's speech and the omission of a social care plan? What's happening?
Well, I have to say, it did feel, despite the fact that there's a lot of bills, 25 new bills, it felt a bit thin overall. I mean, on the one hand, of course, you've got the pandemic as the number one priority to the Prime Minister and the government. You know, there's no question about that. But even despite that, last year, when we were asking about this, what you're focusing on, they said, well, also, you know, we can do more than one thing at once. You know, Whitehall's got bandwidth to deal with, for example, the Brexit trade deal. That's a real priority of this government. So the government did a lot of work on Brexit last year, as well as the pandemic. So, but what they didn't do was, you know, preparation on things like social care and levelling up. And those were the two big things I thought that actually slightly undermined it for the Prime Minister himself, given how much emphasis he's put on those. So on levelling up, I mean, you know, the fact that we're only going to get a white paper later this year speaks volumes. Tim Montgomery, who used to work in Number 10 in those early days after that election victory, you know, he told me this week that the post-election internal conversation on levelling up, rare as they were often vacuous. He said it was definitely a case of trying to convert a soundbite that tested well in focus groups into something real. Rachel Wolfe, who did draft that Tory manifesto, this week did a really good piece on Con Home, where she talked about measurable tests on things like high street skills, social results, like school results. And that's more detailed than anything any minister's come up with so far. So there is an agenda there. It's just that it's somehow, I think, MPs on all sides just feel a bit frustrated there isn't any beef yet. Social care itself, obviously, the PM may well regret saying, you know, he had, quotes, a clear plan we have prepared, he said in July 19. And there wasn't really a lot in the manifesto. Now, you can expect why there wasn't in much in the manifesto, given what happened in 2017. You know, the Conservatives clearly felt burned about that dementia tax charge, so they tried to play it down. But again, that didn't mean you couldn't get on with the heavy lifting and the thinking. And I think it's no surprise that Daily Mail today has really been pushing it, and yesterday. It's a big issue for older voters, particularly people over 50 whose parents and grandparents having to deal with this on a daily basis. You know, and the Mail said $14 billion has been spent by dementia victims and their families since, you know, the PM's words in July. So I know that there is a plan. Andrew Dilnot says it's not that complicated. He had a plan, just get on with it. So there's, you know, there's a lot of work still to be done on that, I think.
Yeah, Kevin, you've been talking about social care for years and what needs to happen there. But apparently, according to reports, your mate Rishi Sunak is holding up the reforms. Have you spoken to him about it? And what do you think needs to happen now? And are you disappointed by the Queen's speech as well?
Not at all, is the latter, but I'll come back to that. But, I mean, social care is such a thorny issue. That's the problem. So, yes, I've spoken to Rishi about it both before he became Chancellor and since. I think the trouble is every time you actually come to a solution, everybody then criticises it. So it's so difficult to find something that is not a blank check for the taxpayer, which I believe Dilnot is. It's not sustainable in the long term, I think, financially. So all that doesn't put too big a burden on the individuals, as it happens at the moment, as Paul was saying. So I think it's very, very difficult issue. I've been banging on for ages about a German-style social insurance system, which is very sustainable, very scalable. It means we all put a little bit of money aside all the time, like we do for pensions. It's simple as that. The trouble with Dilnot is if it rewards people who blow all the cash before they need care. So we're all people that take all the equity out of their houses or don't have a house or spend all their money, then the state pays for everything. How can that be right? How can that be fair to people who do the right thing and save? So that's why it's very, very difficult. So we've had two select committee inquiries that I've been involved in on this, both the Communities Local Government Select Committee and the joint one with the Health Committee, and we did come to a conclusion cross-party. And a combination of different schemes, including that social insurance system. I think the fear is, of course, to bring something forward and the opposition should go to town on it, as happened to Theresa May. It's very, very difficult. But it will come this year. It's understandable, I think, over the last 12, 18 months that we haven't focused too much on it because of the obvious with COVID. But I think we'll get there this year and it won't be painless. It's going to be tough. But we've got to have resolve and now's the time to do it. There's no question with a healthy majority. In terms of the wider stuff, levelling up is the other big thing that I've been banging about for a long time. Fair deal for the North, I used to call it. I don't agree with Paul. There's no beef. There's 600 billion quid of beef, and that's already been announced, spent over the next 5 years in infrastructure. And they've changed the Green Book formula about where it'll be spent in the past because jobs are more valuable. When you create a job in the South, it's worth 40-odd grand. You create a job in the North, it's worth 20-odd grand. You build a motorway, you're going to have more jobs created in the South, so you build all the motorways in the South. That's how it's worked in the past. Now they changed the Green Book formula, so it's not the only criteria anymore. So that 600 billion quid, a lot more will be spent in the North and the Midlands and the Southwest and other areas. So I think levelling up is really exciting. It's a big ambition. It's a huge task. You know, the disparity, the economic disparity between London and the Southeast and the Northeast in relative terms is as big as it was between East and West Germany prior to reunification, 2.5 times. Phenomenally big gap. So this is going to take 3 decades to resolve it. And that's why it took Germany. And they haven't narrowed it completely yet. It's going to take 3 decades and $2 trillion it cost us, Germany spent on narrowing that gap. We've got to be in for the long haul, which is right. Well, it's absolutely right to get things right at the start, but also commit to do this over the longer term.
Rachel, do you agree with Kevin there that you know we are seeing levelling up? And do you think the PM knows exactly what he wants to do and what the strategy is?
Not quite. I don't think he's quite there yet. I think there is a lot of positive stuff in the Queen's speech, but I think there's a couple of big things that could really undermine it. It's social care, as we've just spoken about, cutting the rate of universal credit could particularly at the with the level of joblessness we're likely to see coming out of the pandemic. I think if that's like chopped away, I think that might fly in the face of claims of levelling up. And I also think something else that looks incredibly unfair is the demand for voter ID, which I think just looks like it is excluding certain people who are disenfranchised. And I think that's also going to, it's perhaps of a slightly different agenda, but I think it really could come back to bite the government if it doesn't kind of nip that in the bud.
Yeah, Kevin, it's not very Tory, this idea of having to carry ID cards around to stuff. Boris Johnson famously said he'd eat an ID card if he was asked to show it and masticate it so you couldn't read it anymore or something like that.
Well, Ruth Middleton called it total bollocks last night.
Well, she's not She's not averse to a bit of frank and straightforward language, is she? I don't agree. I mean, I think most people are shocked the fact you don't have to prove your ID when you go in a polling station. You have to prove it to get a package from the post office, for Christ's sake. You have to show, apparently, your ID before you go into a Labour group meeting. So I mean,
not photo ID though for the postal.
Well, I stand corrected. But I mean, it's not an ID card.
You don't need photo ID for a parcel. You can give them your bank card.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you can get the new voter ID cards from the from your local council. It's not going to be you have to show your passport or your driving license. There's a system in place for that. It's been happening in Northern Ireland for many years. I understand. I don't see the problem with it. And if it gives people more confidence in the system. So I don't agree with Rachel that this is something that's going to have a big public backlash at all. I think the public will probably think it was sensible in the first place. I don't really see.
Ruth said there was no evidence for it.
Well, that's not true. There's not that many prosecutions because the Electoral Commission doesn't take forward many prosecutions on it. But there is significant evidence of voter fraud in the past. There's no question about it, including some gratuitous cases, mainly involving Labour authorities, I've got to say.
Kevin, I wanted to pick up on something you said, and you said it in the Commons yesterday as well, and it was actually John McDonnell who first said this a few years ago about the inequality between West and East Germany and the fact that it's going to take decades to sort out the North-South divide. Does that make it difficult for your party, you know, going into possibly the next election to say, you know, we promised to do this and we've done it? Because you can't really say that, can you? Because there is still going to be a divide.
I think it's important to manage expectations, is that this isn't going to happen overnight. So I think there are some things you can do really quickly. I didn't realise I had anything in common with John McDonnell, but there you have. Again, that's something I tried, something I didn't know. But, you know, there's some things we can do more quickly. So, yes, building a road or a railway or a new railway station takes a while to have economic effect. But other things can happen more quickly, such as relocation of civil service jobs. So we moved Treasury North coming to Darlington, you've got Cabinet Office gone to Glasgow, Michael Gove was there this week, you've got the UK Investment Bank coming to Leeds. So things have happened pretty quickly, and that's all there now, or just about being put in place now. Free ports as well, these tax-free zones, will attract a lot of private sector investment. This is the key to it. Mark Littlewood from the IEA said some time ago, if this is all about connectivity, road and railways, why isn't Doncaster more prosperous? Because it's a really well-connected place. You've got to get the private sector investing too. And that's why the government's made these tax breaks for businesses in certain parts of the country. So Teesside, the Humber, part of Humber, for example, will get these new tax status that will really incentivize businesses to set up and expand in those areas. So some things like more quickly, whether they do something in terms of the tax system, that's the quickest way to change people's outcomes in terms of the tax system. One thing I disagree with Rachel on, I don't think this is all about benefits. It's good jobs we want. That's what we really want. We don't want benefits in the North, extra benefits. We want good jobs.
And I would agree. But I think one thing that I didn't hear, and Paul and I discussed this earlier, the government has talked an awful lot about equality of opportunity, but not about outcomes. And I think it's really important to think about how levelling up might be measured. Is it going to be measured by a reduction in child poverty? Is it going to focus on the unemployment rate? You know, how are you going to say, we promised to level up and this is how we were successful because life has got better for the people we said we were going to help?
That's a very, very valid point. One thing I think we really need to do is move to a single measure of poverty. There's too much argument about whether we use relative poverty or absolute poverty. You know, there's a key principle getting anything done. It's in a book called Good to Great by Jim Collins. And one of the key principles, you've got to confront the brutal facts. If you can't agree on the facts, you can't really do anything because you can't agree what the measures are going to put in place and then measure them. So I agree with that, the measures, and I think some of the things you outlined would be sensible, as well as things like average wages, for example, would be a good measure that we should use. But it's very dangerous measuring outcomes, though, rather than opportunities, because clearly not everyone makes the best of their opportunities, and this has got to be about the individual as well as the state. In fact, it's much more about the individual than the state. For me, you create a fair and level playing field, a stable framework that encourages investment, and things like infrastructure are really important to do that, as well as the tax breaks, and then let people get on with it. Good businesses setting up, scaling up, good people willing to retrain themselves or get good qualifications and enter the world of work. The state can't do everything. It's more down to individuals than it is down to the state.
Yeah, you mentioned the tax system there and how that can help levelling up. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, I think there's some things that are inbuilt in the tax system aren't particularly fair. Council tax would be one of them, for example. I think there's a proportionately higher burden on certain parts of the country in terms of council tax. I mean, very expensive properties in London, for example, pay a fraction of the council tax we pay in a much smaller house in the north. That just can't be fair. Yeah. So there's ways you could do things like that. I'm not trying to preempt what the Chancellor might do, but again, business rates, I think, is due for reform. Lots of different things we could do to make it a fair and more level playing field, which would then encourage investment in different parts of the country. One of the real pluses of the COVID crisis is we've found this ability to work in different ways, just like we are doing now. That's a real opportunity for different parts of the country, rather than thinking you have to be in striking distance of the City of London to actually have a successful enterprise. So real opportunities there. Just some tweaks around the edges could really make the North fly much more quickly than it would do otherwise.
Yeah, last one on this. Theresa May looks like she's going to lead a rebellion against the proposed planning reforms. I was just wondering where you are on that. And does it speak to the difficulty your party has now when you're trying to keep people in the Red Wall happy, but you're also trying to keep people in the traditional Tory shires happy? And how do you do that?
Yeah, it's definitely an issue. It's definitely a tough thing to do. And that the formula that we're using for housing allocation, for example, is a good example of that. But I think based upon flawed thinking in terms of the allocating more properties to expensive areas in the hope that prices would fall, that just doesn't work in the housing market. So a market I've been involved in for 30 years, you just create more demand into those areas. So that's been dropped. But the planning reforms, I think, are excellent. You know, it's so bureaucratic a system now. And the big developers, your Barratts, your Persimmons, whoever else can cope with that, they've got armies of fantastically well-qualified people who can take things through the plan system, no problem. And no particular rush. They've got this conveyor belt approach to all the development. So they're quite happy. But if you're an SME, and SMEs used to build 2/3 of the houses in this country, and now they build 23% of the houses in this country. And one of the big issues they've got is the planning system. That we don't allocate the land for them. And when we do, it's hugely bureaucratic. And then they face just about the same burden, the same cost of putting a small development of 10 houses together and developing it as you would do a 1,000 house development. It can't be right. So what this does, it makes it simple. It says that part of town, this is what we think is a growth area. These are the kind of ways we want houses to look. So you do that all at the design stage. You want them to be this brick and this pan tiles, whatever, and these kind of windows. And you've got some land, get on with it. That's what they say. And that makes, so all the work is done right at the start when the plan making process happens, instead of that being duplicated, triplicated through all the way through the process as happens currently. So I think I don't agree with Theresa May on it. I think as long as the plan making stage is done properly, like it is, should be doing now, then it should be fine. And the other thing it does is puts a lot of pressure on local authorities to actually get a plan in place. So York, for example, hasn't had a local plan for 60 years. 60 years. Just absolutely wrong, which then obviously inhibits development, which is bad for the rest of the country and bad for York itself. So it really gets all the work done up front and lets developers get on with it, which is a much better idea.
Yeah, well, let's see what happens, how those planning reforms look at the end of the parliamentary battle that's coming. But whatever criticisms Boris Johnson may face over the Queen's speech, I suspect he won't be too bothered following last week's stunning local election success for the party. As we discussed last week, the Tories continued their march on Labour's former Red Wall, winning the Hartlepool by-election and making gains in swathes of working class areas. The results appeared to show that voters didn't care too much about the allegations of sleaze, which this week intensified after David Cameron's cringeworthy lobbying text to ministers were laid bare by the Commons Treasury Committee. But let's just hear Johnson's verdict on the local elections.
If there's a lesson out of this whole election campaign, the whole election, local election campaign across the whole of the UK, it's that the public want politicians to get on with focusing on their needs and their priorities. So,
Paul, Johnson effectively said there that voters didn't care about sleaze, which Labour hammered in the run-up to the local elections. We're seeing more stuff come out this week on the Greensill scandal. Was Johnson right?
Well, there is a point, a bigger point here, which is you know, and we just touched on it about the idea of a possible Tory rebellion on planning, for example. The overriding thing to remember is just what an amazing campaign a prime minister is and what a brilliant vote winner he is. And I think that sometimes his own side have forgotten that since 2019. Sometimes, you know, there've been rebellions on, you know, COVID recovery group. There's been all sorts of little groups of this and that, pressure groups on the back benches. It's almost as if they've forgotten that he delivered them a massive majority. And because of that big majority, it's like somehow, you know, there's a sort of, they feel as if there's been allowed to freelance on various subjects. Now, he seems quite chilled out about all of that, but I suspect that as this parliament goes on, it might get a bit tougher on things like when his own side are saying, you know, we're unhappy about this and that, because he'll say, look, I've delivered once, I've delivered twice now in the May elections. You're just going to have to stick with me on various things. And I think Sleaze is one of them. And he's obviously, you know, we had Peter Mandelson on the podcast the other week saying, look, Sleaze isn't going to be enough for Labour to win an election. Of course it isn't. He's been around the block. He knows that. He knows the only reason Labour won in 97 was competence. And if the government don't keep an eye on competent government, then they might well be in trouble. But at the idea that this is just the beltway issue is I think wrong, because look, we saw that with the Dominic Cummings issue. When Cummings broke the rules last year, you might have said, oh well, who cares, he's a special advisor, he's unelected, no one really cares, that's a beltway, that's a Westminster issue. That was the initial reaction, but the public really, really hated that. I mean, they hated it because of that very simple point about, you know, one law for them, one law for us. And you might say, well, why was that? You know, he's Dominic Cummings, who cares? But the public clearly cared, and I think that's the danger of the government. If they're a bit too complacent about Sleaze, then the public might, you know, bite them on the backside with it. And it comes back again to what Kevin said, which was, you know, a level playing field and is what most of the public want. Let's be honest, most of the public don't engage in politics most of the time. What they want is a sense of British fairness and that the system's not working against them, and then they can be allowed to get on with life, their own lives. Now, the only way Labour's going to make any inroads into this whole Sleaze issue is if it can somehow marry that sense of fairness and unfairness with what's happened. And I think that there is a wider point as well, which is, yeah, the public might not actually poll particularly well when it comes to things like the PM's wallpaper. They don't really care. But, you know, it's not the Prime Minister's, it shouldn't be the Prime Minister's approach to life to sort of focus group, you know, standards in public life. That's why we have watchdogs, not focus groups policing it. So I think he's got to do a lot more about integrity and putting his own sort of sense of responsibility on there. And we saw a hint of it this week, actually, in that, I think in that press conference on Monday, he was a much more somber Prime Minister, so, and much more cautious and saying, look, it's like he realised he'd got, again, this massive mandate, just as he did after 2019. He realised, look, I've got to deliver on this. I've got to get serious. And I think that's why he was incredibly cautious on Monday about unlocking. And I think that's, he can realise actually that's what the public want to hear.
Yeah, and he was somber after the referendum as well in 2016, of course, that famous photo of him and Gove. But Kevin, do the Sleaze allegations, the flat, the holiday, the stuff around Cameron, it's sort of separate, but not in a way. Do they worry you? I saw you giving it back to Labour yesterday in the Commons. Do you think it's a plague on all their houses?
Exactly my phrase. I think it's a huge mistake by Labour. And don't get me wrong, I absolutely came into this because I believe in politics. I believe the vast majority of people are in politics to do the right thing. And I think, and we make our mistakes, and we must be seen to be doing the right thing. When we make mistakes, we should hold our hands up and say we got this wrong. And if there's any corruption, we should hound it out and we should sack those involved. Absolutely no question about it. But that's not the evidence. I mean, Rachel Reeves yesterday, I find it so hypocritical. Rachel Reeves stood there and talked about people pocketing money, implying that MPs or ministers, somebody was taking bribes. It's absolutely wrong. Rachel Reeves emailed me, I work in the Cabinet Office, PPS to Michael Gove, emailed me personally on a number of occasions to try and get her businesses in her constituency to the front of the queue, because she said she had people who could produce PPE. Of course we take that seriously, and of course we want to try and see if, because we're desperate for the stuff. And like any other MP, to imply then that somehow that Tory companies or people associated with the Tory party were getting ahead of the game compared to Labour. Absolute nonsense, total hypocrisy. And the National Audit Office, a completely independent body, looked at this and determined there's no ministerial involvement in any of the decisions about PPE. So it's absolutely wrong that Labour try and go on this. And all it does is trash what's remaining of the good name of politics. It's a massive mistake. And so I think we've much more responsible approach to this. So I don't think it's something that really cuts through. I think the average kind of person in the street who's a floating voter will probably think, well, the politicians are all at it. That's what they might think of this. And so it's not really doing anything for Labour, and it's trashing politics generally, and it's not getting them ahead. I think it should absolutely stop it. In terms of Greensill, again, I think the biggest, the only thing I can see there that really has any kind of substance to it is the fact David Cameron's made a huge mistake aligning himself with a company like that. I think he was working for Greensill. He had a paid role within that organisation. Of course, he's going to try and lobby whoever he could to try and get support for them if they were in danger of going bust, which they did. So, and of course, the Treasury then looked at it and looked at this impartially and decided that Greensill weren't the schemes available. The CCFF scheme wasn't appropriate to use for Greensill because you can't use it for financial companies, and that's what they were. So, and they were rejected. So again, you know, if Labour want to try and make that into something it's not, and there should be a proper inquiry, as there are a number of inquiries into wallpaper, into PPE, there'll be inquiry now into the COVID crisis, of course, a full independent public inquiry, and lots of select committees looking at all these things. Of course, they should be allowed to do their work and hold people responsible if there's wrongdoing. But to simply say that people are guilty before being proven as so, it goes against all the principles that I was told. That in the UK, you're innocent until proven guilty, so proper investigation over these things has been carried out.
Kevin, have you ever received a text from David Cameron signed off Love DC?
I never have. I really feel left out. And I came in the same year as Rishi as well. I'm just, if he wasn't such a great guy, I'd be really envious, but he's such a great guy. So I wish him all the best, how well he's done and how well connected he is these days. But Rishi does stuff right. And then I think we did, whether it be officials or ministers, I think the inquiries will do their work and we should wait for the outcome. But I haven't seen anything yet that to suggest that they've done anything wrong.
It's not very edifying though, is it? You know, those texts from David Cameron to ministers, 55, I think they were in the end, something like that.
No, it's not edifying. You're absolutely right. And David Cameron said that. He would do things differently, use proper channels next time. It doesn't look right. It's not right. They were clearly pretty desperate, I think it's fair to say. And understandably, you've got a huge organisation that's, whatever he's doing that was right or wrong, and there's, I think, a potential criminal investigation from the FCA being undertaken. But, there's no doubt a lot of businesses struggle as a result of its failure, and lots of investors will lose money as a result of its failure, through Credit Suisse, for example, particularly. So you can see they were desperate to try and get some financial lifeline at the time. So I think that drove what is some unedifying behaviour. You're quite right.
Yeah, just last one. Do you think it's right that a former Prime Minister can directly access sort of the Chancellor and say, can you look at our business's proposal and other firms can't?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair point, and we should look at that. I mean, those have been the rules in the past that haven't prevented that. But I think we should look at that and decide what the rules should be and how long a Prime Minister might have to be outside the world of politics before they do something else. And I think we've got to be careful we don't sever the connections between business and politics any more than we want to sever the connections between our health services and politics. You want to know what's going on. And I've been in business 30 years, still got business connections now. And I think that's healthy for Parliament, for people to be in Parliament who've been in the real world and understand how things work. But I think it's, we need to restore the good name of politics, if it ever had one. And I think the more things are seen to be done in the right way, the right channels. I think John Penrose, who's the Prime Minister's corruption czar, made some very good speech a couple of weeks ago when he said, basically, we've got to be more transparency. All this stuff has got to be properly documented. Any correspondence, any meeting, it's not just say you had a meeting with a certain person from a certain business or certain whatever else. This is what was discussed. And make it far more transparent. I think that would help.
Do you think APPGs should change? Because there seems to be a lot of lobbying done via APPGs.
Well, I think there are some financial rules around them, certainly that prevent lobbying too directly through APPGs. I mean, I chair a few, and probably too many. And one I do on fair business banking, I think does some brilliant work. And we do need funding. You can't get the people to do the work unless you have some funding for them. And that comes from various different sources, including some of the banks themselves. And we get criticism for that. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, as I said before, I think most parliamentarians are decent, honest people. They're not here to try and line their pockets, as some people would try and portray. And I think the media itself as well, Arge, Paul, I've got to say, you know, I think you've got a key role. If we together ourselves point the finger at each other, like a circular firing squad, and the media help with that, saying, implying that all politicians are either corrupt or incompetent or self-serving, I think the only people that ever get to sign up for politics in the future will be the corrupt, the self-serving, and the incompetent. So it really doesn't help. I'm not saying the media are always doing that, but they do at times, and I don't think it helps.
A real final one now. Couldn't Boris Johnson have just told us who initially gave the money to wallpaper his flat, and then we wouldn't be in this position?
Possibly. Yeah, I mean, that's...
That's not the media's fault.
I don't say we always get things right. I agree, Rachel. So I'm not blaming everything on the media. I think the media does a fantastic job, can I just say? And, you know, in some of the campaigns we run, particularly the banking thing, the media's been brilliant. We couldn't get anywhere near where we've got to with certain things like holding Lloyds and RBS to account without the media. So, it's really important that we have this, the media that we do. But I think we shouldn't be afraid of just telling it like it is and providing, publicly, putting things in the public domain that people think they're interested in knowing about. Although you've got to be a bit careful, you just don't have to respond to every kind of accusation. But anyway, the inquiries will take place.
We're running out of time here. We were going to discuss the relaxation of COVID rules, but we don't really have time. But I'm just going to ask you, any of you, who are you going to cautiously cuddle on Monday?
Can I cuddle my niece's 21st birthday actually this Monday.
Perfect.
I've got some really good friends that we haven't seen for ages, so we're going for a walk with them, and we'll inevitably, whenever we see them, we want to give them a hug, but we'll be able to do it.
It's going to be surreal scenes in the parks on Monday with everyone going around arm in arm, but it should be lovely. Anyway, just before you go, Kevin, we're going to do a quick quiz, and in a turnaround of the usual format, Rachel is going to ask the questions this week. Okay. So fire away.
Oh. Yeah, I'm just going to point out in the first instance that I'm doing the quiz because Arj accidentally emailed the quiz and the quiz answers to me and Paul last night.
Okay, you could have sent it to me.
So I'd just like to take that opportunity to embarrass me slightly. So my quiz this week is reshuffle themed after Keir Starmer reshuffled his shadow cabinet, sacking Annalise Dodds and replacing his shadow chancellor with Rachel Reeves. I have questions on reshuffles in the past. So In a last-ditch effort to hang on to power, Tony Blair reshuffled his cabinet after a disappointing set of council results. He demoted Jack Straw, but to what position?
Commons leader.
Yes, I'll just write. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well done.
Good.
Okay, after winning the Tory leadership in 2019, Boris Johnson axed a number of Theresa May's ministers. How many?
God.
How many?
Yeah. 15.
Bloody hell.
More than that. Probably 40.
Close.
I'd say something like 19, something like that.
Yeah, both almost right.
Oh, can I have a guess then? 17.
Yes, Arj gets the point.
Yes!
quick bonus question. Name three.
Oh, what's she called?
George Osborne.
Three who... George
Nicky
Freeman.
Nicky Morgan.
George Freeman was one, yes.
Mel Stride.
Yes.
Very good.
Who else? Damien Hines.
Yes.
Yes.
Very good. Oh, well done, Kevin.
Okay. Margaret Thatcher's reshuffle of 1981, when she faced a lot of criticism of her economic policy. She sacked Christopher Soames as leader of the Lords, but who did she replace him with?
Strathclyde. God.
No.
Hailsham. Hailsham? No. No, he was Lord Chancellor. God, that's a tough one.
Are we allowed to Google it?
Who would she replace?
I've no idea, actually.
Give us a clue, Rachel.
Who's the first female leader of the Lords? Oh.
Boothroyd.
No.
Rogue Dartey.
Oh,
first
yes.
female leader of the Lords.
I was 1 year old or something like that this
time. God almighty. Yeah, exactly.
Janet Young.
Oh, right.
Oh, God. That'd have been guessing for a long time.
Oh, God. Wow.
And final bonus point. Who said this after the 1981 reshuffle? It does no harm to throw the occasional man overboard, but it does not do much good if you are steering full speed ahead for the rocks.
Francis Pym? Was it Francis Pym? No. Oh, it's another wet. Some other wet. Heseltine?
No.
No.
It was Ian Gilmore who she removed Lord Privy Seal and demoted to Northern Ireland Secretary.
Yeah, he was a wet, dripping wet.
Who's won then, Rachel?
I think it was you. Arne.
Yes, yes. Well done. I would expect so.
Played 1-1-1.
Yeah, it's a pretty good record.
Okay, Kevin, you've got to go, so please go. Thanks very much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks
really nice
invite.
To have you on.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much. All the best, everybody.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to my guests for joining me, and make sure you subscribe to Commons People on all the usual channels, and please be sure to leave a review and get your daily dose of what's happening in Westminster by subscribing to the Warzone newsletter at bit.ly/the-war-zone. We'll just leave you with Boris Johnson reflecting on Angela Rayner's reshuffle power play against Keir Starmer.
In any pride of lions, Mr. Speaker, it is the male who tends to occupy the position of titular, of nominal authority, while the most dangerous beast, the prize hunter of the pack, is in fact the lioness. A point that I am sure the Right Honourable Gentleman bears in mind as he contemplates the member, his friend, the Right Honourable Member for Ashton-under-Lyne, the Deputy Leader, the Shadow's First Secretary of State, the Shadow Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster and Shadow Secretary of State for the future of work. Though the more titles he feeds her, Mrs. Speaker, the hungrier I fear she is likely to become.